This is People First Radio On Demand, podcasts, streaming, and MP3 downloads, available when you want to listen at chly.ca and at the People First Radio website.
CHLY 101.7 FM, Vancouver Island. On the web, www.chly.ca.
In Vancouver's Chinatown, seniors who speak only Cantonese or Mandarin face discrimination, marginalization, and a lack of affordable, culturally and linguistically appropriate housing. Research suggests the problem will worsen as these vulnerable seniors, already living in poverty and isolation, continue to age. Tai Yi housing reporter Jackie Wong has revealed in a special series of articles the widely felt but seldom discussed discrimination that Chinese seniors face every day. She also looks at innovative housing solutions for seniors in Toronto and San Francisco.
And Jackie Wong joins us on the phone today. Welcome back to People First Radio, Jackie.
Thanks very much for having me back on the show, Kevin.
What led you to writing these articles?
Well, you know, these articles were based on a number of issues related to housing, ethnicity, and the experience of immigrants that have been on my mind for quite a few years. For a long time, I've been fascinated by Vancouver's Chinatown and Chinatowns generally because I've been interested in how Chinatown is, on the one hand, a place of vibrant community, and then also, on the other hand, a place of really striking isolation for some residents. But I just didn't really know how to write about it. And then in recent years, I started hearing about the discrimination and poverty facing Chinese-speaking seniors in very casual conversations, but never really in a formal context. And so I could see that people could see it and they could feel it in the community, but they didn't know how to talk about it, and neither really did I. And then just a couple of years ago, I teach an introductory journalism class for Downtown Eastside community members. And during one of the classes, a student started telling me about the racial tension that he was observing between Chinese and English-speaking community members in the Downtown Eastside, because he was also not only in the class, but he was working as an outreach worker in the community. And he was really concerned about the racism that he was seeing in the food lineups and drop-in centers where he worked. And then I could also start to become aware of this, too, when I was walking down the streets. And then finally, this January 2013, this is after a few years, I started work for the Tai Yi Solution Society, which funded this project. And in the preparation for starting research, I had a meeting with an urban planner and researcher named Andy Yan, who specializes in issues concerning ethnic communities. And then he started telling me about the terrible poverty of elder Chinese-speaking seniors in the Downtown Eastside. And from there, I really knew that I really wanted to write about it.
Now, there are four articles posted online at the Tai Yi in this series. The first one is focused on a struggle for resources. As recently as 2011, UBC's Center for Urban Economics and Real Estate contended that of all elderly ethnic immigrant groups in Vancouver, the shortfall of social housing is greatest among Chinese seniors. Tell us more about what you described as the struggle for resources.
Right. Well, I think that the main barriers that Chinese-speaking seniors face can be kind of boiled down to two main issues. One, they face limited access to social supports like housing and health services that serve their language community. So they lack supports in their language. And then secondly, they're living at a time where housing affordability in general is a huge challenge for people across the Lower Mainland. And this is particularly an issue for people with low incomes or people who are renting in the private rental market. So many of the Chinese-speaking seniors living in Chinatown are low-income, and they're facing affordability issues similar to their neighbors. But language barriers compound the affordability challenges because they are trying to access limited resources available to anybody in the inner city, but they're also pitted against English language speakers in food lineups and drop-in centers and in community spaces that aren't always optimally set up to help or deal with people who don't speak English.
You describe a senior named Jay Foon and her 14 friends who shared some time together at the Downtown Eastside Women's Center. They're strapped for cash after paying for housing, you write, just like others in the area who stand in food lineups. They tell you that while they don't always feel welcome in the Downtown Eastside, they deserve to be there as much as anybody else. What did you learn about the discrimination experienced by elderly Chinese people?
The discrimination that the elder women described to me tells me that racism is still very much alive today. despite some institutional gains that we've made towards equality. And then also the racism and discrimination also tells me that there's a number of faulty assumptions that are made on the part of English-speaking society about Chinese-speaking seniors, and namely that they are wealthy enough not to need the resources that people are lining up for and competing for in the downtown east side. And then there's also the assumption that seniors or immigrant families are taken care of by their families. But that, of course, is a generalization that is not real for everybody. As we know, family breakdown happens, and relationship breakdowns between family members is one reason that I've heard why a number of Chinese-speaking seniors are living by themselves in Chinatown and the downtown east side, and that's one of the reasons why they are struggling to afford their housing and also struggling for the limited resources in the area.
In your discussions with elderly Chinese residents in the area, you spoke also with Soji Kwan, who is 65 years old, and she imitates what she has experienced in being sworn at quite heavily in the streets. This is very in-your-face kinds of treatment. What did you hear about that?
Yes, it's very. I was surprised and quite saddened by how aggressive the behavior seems to be for some people. And I think that what it comes down to, and what I think that it's important not to take away from this series, is that it's not a situation of people in the downtown east side being like really, you know, mean or discriminatory across the board. But I think that the situation comes down to one of poverty and exceptional barriers that a lot of people have been facing in their lives. I think that some of the abuse that people are enduring, like the violent verbal abuse that Soji Kwan was describing, comes through a legacy of people having experienced abuse themselves. And sometimes people experience big barriers to education that might prevent somebody from understanding, what racist behavior is, or what kind of, this is a hugely vulnerable and very diverse population that is hurting. And I think that it's a sign that maybe more attention needs to be paid to how to address some of the challenges that are facing everybody in the neighborhood.
You write about the benevolent associations that were formed about a century ago. You describe the help and support they provided, but you also document their withdrawal, or observe their withdrawal from the field. Tell us more about the benevolent associations.
Well, the Chinese benevolent associations, they were foundational pillars of the Chinatown community in Vancouver before the Second World War, because at that time, the Chinese head tax and also the Chinese Immigration Act limited the type of immigration that could take place in Canada. And so those policies often prohibited families from coming to Canada together. So families would often send their sons alone. The idea was that those sons would work in Canada and send money back home to their families, who were often living in very poor villages in rural China. And so benevolent associations, they kind of came up in Chinatown out of necessity. They were sort of like stand-in families for people who were living by themselves. And just like a family does, these benevolent associations often provided housing and also, of course, a source of community and companionship for people people who needed it. But then after the Second World War in 1947, the federal government repealed the Chinese Immigration Act, and then also the Chinese head tax had been repealed in 1923. So by that time, after the war, families were reunited in Canada because people's partners and children could come to join them. And because real families came back together, the kind of stand-in family that the benevolent association provided kind of faded to the background. And an interesting part of my research was that a Chinatown historian who lives on the island, his name is David Lai, and he lives in Victoria, he was telling me that during our interviews that he thinks that the survival of old Chinatowns, like traditional Chinatowns in Vancouver and Victoria, depend on the survival of the benevolent associations. And meanwhile, I was having a hard time finding benevolent associations willing to talk to me about housing because their role has been quite diminished, and they were largely referring me to an organization called Success, which mostly takes charge of housing for Chinese-speaking seniors in Vancouver. But, you know, I was also told that benevolent associations have been historically the domain of older Chinese community members, and this afternoon I'm actually going to be meeting with a younger person in his 30s who's involved with benevolent associations, and he actually reached me after he read the series, and I'm really looking forward to learning about what benevolent associations are doing now, especially with regard to housing, because that was something that that I wasn't able to find out a lot about in the course of working on this series.
Mm-hmm. And I found it interesting that you commented on the benevolent group's early work was focused on lonely bachelors. And then, as you noted, this whole kind of change after World War II, and now we have situations in which the Confucian obligation, as you talk about, for children to take care of their parents, it's really a great expectation is what you're hearing from people in the field. And you learned this in San Francisco. You went to Toronto and San Francisco. What did you see in those cities?
Well, you know, I'm afraid that I was not actually able to travel to Toronto or San Francisco.
Oh, I thought you had gone there.
Only able to talk to the people who were working.
That's okay. That's okay.
Working in those agencies. Okay. But nonetheless, I found that the models in both Toronto and San Francisco were really very inspiring. I mean, thinking again about how families, you know, whether they're brought together by blood relatives or through other kinds of community connection, like to kind of focus on that sort of very personal and holistic kind of community that a family can bring, I found to be very much alive in both Toronto and San Francisco. In Toronto, the Yihong Geriatric Care Centers provide linguistically and culturally appropriate care to Chinese-speaking seniors across Greater Toronto. So there are 4 facilities, 805 beds, and 3 adult day centers. And so that's like 8 times more beds than Vancouver has through Success. And it's amazing in terms of just the size and the scope of that service because the Yihong Geriatric Centers have only been around since the mid-90s, which is not a long time. And then meanwhile in San Francisco, they have a very interesting holistic model there through the Unlock Lifeways Adult Day Centers. And those keep seniors living independently in their homes, but they also provide a community of care. And so the way it works is that the Unlock Lifeways Day Centers employ drivers to pick up seniors from their homes in the morning, and then they take them to one of 7 adult day centers in the San Francisco area. And then those day centers are kind of a one-stop hub for all of the seniors' healthcare needs. So they come to the center, they can have a meal, they see their friends, but they can also see a doctor, a counselor, a social worker, and a lot of folks who, you know, usually families would be burdened with kind of shuttling them around from appointment to appointment, but the day centers allow people just to have it all in one place. And I think that the really neat thing behind those day center models and the way that they work is that they have seniors not only, you know, building support among each other as friends and peers, but they're also interacting with care providers on a daily basis so that they can ward off health emergencies, which are often very straining for families, through, you know, a preventative, holistic approach to health.
Dr. Joseph Wong, who is associated with the Toronto Project, is quoted in your article as saying there's a sizable percentage of the Chinese seniors that he has seen that have become suicidal. And he's talking about seniors who arrive as transfers from Western care facilities. Quote, their depression has been aggravated from being in a non-appropriate setting for them. Tell us just a little bit more in the last couple moments here, the importance of having culturally appropriate settings and services.
Yes, well, I think that, you know, any of us can relate, I think, as individuals to the difficulty that we might face if we were receiving care, health care, if we were very ill and receiving health care in a language community that was not our own, and how isolating and scary that could be. And I think that for the Chinese-speaking seniors that Dr. Wong was seeing in Toronto, which inspired him to form the Yihong Geriatric Care Centers, he saw the difference that it made for somebody to understand a senior and be able to communicate with them in their own language. And I think that it speaks to a desire for all of us as humans to be known and to be understood and to feel like we can be heard, especially during times of crisis or personal health crisis. And I think that is really something that can be applied to all language communities, not just the Chinese language community.
Jackie Wong, thank you very much for, number one, doing this work and writing these excellent articles, also for taking the time to join us today.
It's a real pleasure, Kevin. Thank you so much for having me. I really enjoyed talking to you.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Jackie Wong is working with the Taiyi Solution Society to explore affordable housing issues and solutions. You can find her articles online at thetaiyi.ca.
This is a People First Radio podcast. People First Radio is an initiative of Columbian Center Society in partnership with the Radio Malaspina Society and produced at CHLY Community Radio in Nanaimo, British Columbia. The opinions expressed in this interview do not necessarily reflect the opinions of the partnering organizations. Visit us online. Just Google People First Radio to find our webpage.